Paranormal.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, being broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. I'm Dee Andrew, and my guest tonight is Keith Chester. If you'd like to send in questions for either myself or for Keith, you can email them to eyetothesky@cox.net. That's E-Y-E, the number 2, the sky, at Cox, C-O-X, dot net. Or you can, if you're in our virtual auditorium, private message them to me from the room to the name D-Dragon 8. Or you can post them in the room if you wish, and or you can get up on your microphone on your computer and ask your questions. And Keith, I was saying in the book, or during the break, that I had equate your book and the work behind it with that of Rich Dolan's UFOs in the National Security State. I think both of them are wonderful historic documents on the subject. And I personally want to thank you for doing this body of work. It's really good.
Oh, I appreciate that. And to be labeled in with Mr. Dolan is a real honor, because I understand the type of work he had to put in to assemble all that material over so many years and decades. He is what I was trying to achieve, his level of his history-making type of reporting.
Well, I think it'd be very, very valuable body of work. Wow, real quick response. We have a question already. The question is, I've read stories that crop circles were found in England during World War II, and that originally it was thought that these formations were some sort of directional markers for German bombers made by German agents in England. It was also reported that in some instances, Foo Fighter-type objects were seen in the area before these crop circles were found. Have you ever heard of any of these crop circle Foo Fighter stories from World War II?
No, but that's very interesting. And again, unfortunately, like I said earlier, I've only really had the chance to look at a small amount of material, and like I said, the civilian sightings I didn't cover. And if it wasn't in the National Archives, I pretty much, or some of the more popular literature, I wasn't aware of it. But I'm not surprised by that, and to be totally honest, I can't take for credit for knowing anything about that. Again, it just shows that we're adding more and more information during that particular time that shows the phenomenon was very, very extensive and had a lot of different attributes to it. And, of course, that's the first I've heard anything about crop circle-related sightings. I'm sorry I couldn't really answer any better than that.
Oh, that's all right. You don't know, you don't know. No harm in that. Another one sent to us from Taldworth. He asks, what are roughly the last reported sightings dates in the European and Pacific theaters? Anything similar or mysterious observations in the Korean or Vietnam theaters?
Yes, I'd say that the last observation in Europe was all the way into May, when Germany surrendered. And then the Pacific theater, the last known sighting that I'm aware of was August 28, 1945, and that was Mr. Stringfield. Now, the phenomenon continued. It continued all the way through in the Korean War, into Vietnam, and there are researchers who are doing research on the Pacific Wars, and I can say to you, yes, the sightings were just as dramatic. There were probably just as many, and the phenomenon just took different terminology. Of course, it was, I'd say, the most popular term we know is the Foo Fighters, which by 1946, turned into a popular term called the ghost rocket. And then by 47, we're hearing flying disc, flying saucer. And that just continued on until, I guess, about 56. if I have it correctly, my timeline, where the term UFO was actually put into place. But yes, the Korean War and the Vietnam War had many sightings, but unfortunately, I just can't give you any specifics.
One case that you put in that was, you know, right about the end of the conflict with Japan was mid-July 1945 over Washington State and the Hanford facility there.
Right. That case came to me via an investigation that Walt Andrus did, the past director of MUFON. And that case is remarkable. Again, it shows that, you know, it was beyond wartime technology, beyond wartime materiel. And radar facility had picked up in Washington State an object, sent up fighters, and again, this object was sitting still, and it was fast moving. It could, you know, stop on a dime. But what's interesting, the pilot actually reported seeing something the size of three aircraft carriers. Now, that's just an amazing thing to see in the sky, and that's probably one of three events that took place throughout the war where the pilots were encountering craft that were huge, that could hang motionless in the sky, and that could speed away at thousands of miles per hour, you know, according to their estimates. So, again, readers and listeners know that there were UFO activity throughout the years over atomic sites, over facilities that had to do with nuclear research and power. And in 1975, I think it was a huge rash of overflights on facilities along the Northeast Corridor all the way into Canada. And so that is a remarkable sight. And again, the problem I'm finding is that these particular amazing sightings that are reported by the pilots, of course, that documentation has been either kept secret, destroyed, or still classified in terms of one day we may be able to get it through FOIA, or an agency will release it. Who knows what the situation is? But that's one of three cases that I came across that had objects that size.
One of the parts of this particular incident that really surprised me was the pilot. His name was Powell. He was flying an F-6F Hellcat, and their ceiling. Our performance altitude ceiling for these things was 37,000 feet, and they were told to push it at the expense of their engine.
Well,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Well, that tells me that there was something so significant they felt there was a threat to put the pilot at risk, you know, of running out of oxygen or stressing the aircraft at the highest altitude possible. Whatever it was, and the fact that they saw it visually and on radar tells me that there was no doubt that they felt there was a threat associated with it, even though nothing that we know of occurred. And again, post-World War II, we have incidents where fighter pilots were chasing what they believed were not balloons, were not conventional aircraft, in some cases causing the pilot to crash his aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, I guess, one of the first reports that I'm aware of pushing an aircraft to its limit during World War II, or within late war.
I have another question from our Pal Talk auditorium, Paul Dwarf again. He asks, was anything witnessed, Foo Fighter UFOs, around Hiroshima or Nagasaki before or after?
Well, yes, after the bombings there were sightings, but there was nothing that I'm aware of that were associated during the bombing missions themselves. I'm not aware of any sightings. But I am aware that, of course, you know, Leonard Stringfield's sighting, of course, was post-atomic, and it's interesting to note regarding that, he feels at that time, he felt that whatever was taking place was brought on by the atomic testing out in New Mexico, or then ultimately the bombs dropped in Japan. He wasn't really aware that the phenomenon itself went back that far. There was an investigation in the Pacific that was conducted because so much was taking place, and that investigation went into mainland Japan in September. So absolutely, things were being seen, and if there were objects being observed during the bombings, I'm not aware of it, but I wouldn't be surprised.
That's interesting, because you think, you know, after two atomic bomb blasts, they'd be all over the place. There's another question here. Was there ever any evidence or report that these anomalous objects showed hostile intent or attacked any of the military aircraft?
No. With the pilots that I interviewed, they never felt that there was hostile intent. What they were saying, they felt they were being monitored. They felt they were being paced, and at the beginning, they felt they were some type of radar detection device that was designed to bring flak into the area. So what they thought were some type of ordnance device was shot up in the air to follow the aircraft so anti-aircraft weapons could zero in on them. But that never occurred. They were never fired at in association with the observations. So I'd have to say that as far as hostile intent, no, it was more hostile intent on the side of our pilots. There were many instances where we fired at these things, we wanted to attack them, and they evaded. It was like cat and mouse that I'm aware of.
A little bit more behind the investigation. There was Greg Alvarez, Robertson, Goldschmidt, a plethora of scientists, but there were a few besides just Robertson that were also involved with the Robertson panel.
Exactly.
I find that very fascinating in light of the recommendations of the Robertson panel.
Exactly. That's what fascinated me. Now, for those who don't know what the Robertson panel was for, from 1947 to 52, there were so many sightings in the United States that they wanted to determine. It was hosted by the CIA. And Dr. Robertson chaired the panel of eminent scientists, which included, of course, Dr. Luis Alvarez, who was a radar expert. He was also the designer of the trigger device that set off the atomic bomb. Dr. Louis Berkner, Dr. Samuel Goudsmit, and Dr. Thornton Page. Interestingly enough, Dr. Goudsmit was the scientific director of what they call the Altus mission, and that was the mission sent in to determine if Germany had an atomic bomb. And so these men are sitting on the Robertson panel in 1953, it's January 1953, to determine if UFOs were a national security threat. And in their report, they discuss how the investigation of the Foo Fighters took place. And as I mentioned earlier, a statement was made in that particular report talking about if flying saucers existed, that term, it would have been so labeled. And these men were on the ground. We had Griggs, who was a radar expert out of the War Department. He was on the ground. He was affiliated with every intelligence operation in the European theater. We had Robertson running out of General Eisenhower's office. We had General Spatz, who was in charge of the United States Strategic Air Forces, and on his advisory staff was Griggs and Robertson. We had General Arnold, who was commanding officer of the entire Army Air Forces, and had Griggs look into the phenomenon. And he looked into the phenomenon in the European theater. This is Dr. David T. Griggs, who was the most knowledgeable, according to the Robertson panel report. He was the most knowledgeable person who looked into the phenomenon. By the time the European theater of operations had stopped, he moved to the Pacific under General Keeney as an advisory staff scientist. he was asked by Arnold to look into the balls of fire. So he got together with the pilots and went up on some of the missions to see if he could see what these guys were reporting. And then by September, he went into Japan with a scientific intelligence mission, and he actually asked some of the Japanese prisoners about if they knew anything about these strange objects being reported. And what he determined were that most had not, and they were not aware of any ordnance devices that could display that type of characteristic beyond their, you know, weaponry they had, which were the Bakas, the piloted missiles, the guided missiles, the rockets, and whatever. What is significant also about Dr. Griggs is he was interviewed by Dr. James McDonald, who is probably one of the shining lights of ufology in terms of, here was a scientist out of the University of Arizona, complete respect across the board. He was brilliant. He was a meteorological physicist, I believe. And he actually contacted Dr. Griggs in 1969 to interview him about Griggs' investigation of the phenomenon. He called him on the phone, and his handwritten notes indicate that Griggs was holding back information. And Griggs told him they never did really find out what it was. He wrote reports, and those reports to this day are still classified. But unfortunately, Dr. McDonald passed away, and no one else took up where he left off in terms of contacting Griggs, because he would have been the key person. Interestingly enough, Dr. Griggs went on to become one of the first employees of what they called the RAND Corporation. And that was a research and development think tank that the United States Air Force utilized for satellite warfare in the future, you name it. Dr. Griggs, of course, was involved with that for several years. And the fact that all these scientists were involved in these investigations indicates to me that the phenomenon was more far-reaching and far more prevalent than we know still to this day. And that's what I'm still trying to uncover with my continued research.
Oh, this next question that's been sent to me kind of goes along with something I wanted to touch on a bit myself. I had noticed you on the Investigation H program recently, I believe on Discovery Channel. And it was on Nazi UFO conspiracy. This question that was sent to me kind of ties in with that. Alien Technosis wanted to know if you knew, or what he would like to know, what is your take on what they call the German flytrap, which is, for the lack of a better term, a Stonehenge-esque concrete structure in, I believe it was, Austria? Or Poland, rather. Poland.
Yes. Well, that particular story came out of a book called The Hunt for Zero Point, which was Nick Cook had put that together, and that research was based on Igor Lukowski, who is an aviation journalist in Poland. And they believe that the Germans were actually developing anti-gravity devices during the war. Now, how that leads into the show that I was part of was when I was contacted by the Discovery Channel, they wanted to find out about, of course, the Foo Fighters. And you, of course, saw me in the beginning and Harold Augsburger, who was the commanding officer. And that led into the fact that, well, let's look at it through another set of eyes. And there are many researchers around the world who believe that the UFO phenomenon was generated or had mostly been put together by Nazi technology of the time. So what I suspect is that what we're seeing is, if it was German technology, if any of that anti-gravity, if any of the Foo Fighter aircraft, whatever it was being observed, then obviously we were looking into it. And I can show that through the investigations that were being conducted through 44 into 45. So, yes, they were looking into this. As far as anti-gravity, I have no clue of if we did look into it, but I can assure you that the scientific investigative team were collecting engineers and scientists' documentation in facilities. If such a weapon system or such research and experimental systems did exist, then we uncovered it. We, or the Russians, or the French, or whoever was sending in their intelligence team. So that's about all I know of it. And I don't know what the listeners think, but there are those who think that the UFO phenomenon can be explained by German UFOs. And I just personally do not think that's the case. Too many sightings around the world in the numbers of the thousands, too many foul ships, sizes, ability, characteristics, maneuverability, everything you can think of. I cannot see how German technology can account for that, considering a lot of that was taking place early in the war and before the war. So it's fascinating, but I don't put much credence in terms of the Germans were working with that type of technology.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. If you look back at artwork that goes back hundreds and even thousands of years, you know, they've been around for a very long time.
Absolutely. I don't want to, there's some great researchers out there who really have put their heart and soul into investigating the German technology end of this. And there's some fascinating, intriguing evidence to suggest that there were UFO-type aircraft on the drawing board. And so, yes, I can see why people would say, well, you know what, maybe some of these things, some of these signs can be attributed to high research and development that the Germans had, but there's nothing that I have seen that indicates that it was in operation other than on the drawing board. And so anything post-World War II, when we have Roswell, which was the show was trying to show that it was probably aircraft put together by the German scientists who were over here, such as von Braun, I'm highly suspect of that.
I agree. Another question that has been sent to me. In your research, did you come across any Foo Fighter sightings over any military bases, whether in Europe or here in the U.S., by personnel on the ground?
No. The only thing I came across, well, personnel on the ground, yes, there were a few incidents where I knew of the radar operators who were leading the fighters in to their objectives. They were aware of the sightings coming in from the pilots, and I have a couple instances where they actually saw objects out of the France. But, of course, they couldn't identify it. This was night. And as far as military installations around the United States, there was one instance, I think, where an aircraft was seen near a town where one of the military installations were. But unfortunately, I just don't know all the details. And some of the information from magazine articles, some of the information from the books, if I didn't have enough information of the details and no witness names, or I really didn't approach it and I left it alone. So, again, if the listener does know of cases, it's because they probably have read it. Maybe they have. It's just that I had to drop a lot from my book to keep it focused on the documentation, more on the documentation, or the witnesses I spoke with.
You've done so much work. Gosh, it's hard to decide what question to ask next. kind of your experience at researching this at the National Archives, you mentioned in your where you wanted to say thank you part, of your book, several people that helped you out there at the National Archives. And what kind of assistance did they give you, and what was their reaction when you told them what you were there to look for?
Well, the archives at the National Archives, it took a couple years. I'd say after 3 years, I start letting on what I was looking for. And I'd have to say most didn't believe it. They thought I was, you know, looking into something that wasn't there, that it all could be accounted for by ordnance, flares, rockets. Most of the archivists there that I've encountered have no belief whatsoever in UFOs. So I never really spoke much about that. And I have to emphasize that it was many, many, many months before I even uncovered my first report, the ones coming out of General Eisenhower's office, because, again, the reports don't say much other than in some of the mission reports, they list sightings under phenomenon. And, again, they were writing as if it was normal ordnance or aircraft. I had to piece all that together, so it was a long haul of looking at documentation that really had nothing to do, per se, on the UFO subject. At the National Archives are the records of Project Blue Book, and those records are primarily those that start probably in 1952 to 69. So I never even approached those records because so many researchers have looked into these over decades. And I was, again, looking into military records of World War II, which became very, very difficult to find anything. And it that was my problem. Most of my time was devoted to that, and I wasn't researching the material that was being generated by the ufological community that were calling information from newspapers and other magazines and books from around the world. So I'm guilty of that. And I almost lost my mind several times trying to figure out why I couldn't find anything until, of course, I found those specific documents that showed there was a phenomenon. I'm sorry?
Oh, I thought you were done. Sorry.
I hope that answers your question.
Oh, okay. I have another question that was sent to me from Gossamer 777, and it goes along this line of questioning as well. He asks, from your research in the National Archives, were you able to find documentation to indicate how far up the chain of command some of these sighting reports went?
Well, absolutely. That's the basis of my book. I wanted to show exactly how far they went up the chain of command. And again, the documentation I found were at the Tactical Air Command. They were at the SHAPE level, which was the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force level, which was General Eisenhower. His staff, his air staff, were generating the reports back and forth. Air Force level unit, the 1st Tactical Air Force, the 8th Air Force. The memoranda that was being passed around between these air forces and commands is what convinced me that there was a definite phenomenon. And yes, so I have one instance in the Pacific where General Arnold hand writes on one of his intelligence daily reports to ask if Dr. von Karman had any idea if the sightings were related to the balls of fire. And what it was, these manned aircraft that were being sent against the B-29 bombers, suicide bombs, basically, he was trying to figure out if that was what it was. And so you have General Arnold, who is the commanding general of the Army Air Forces, asking Dr. Theodore von Karman, who was heading the complete Army Air Force investigation of the best technology available. It was Arnold who had the foresight to look into saying, look, the Germans are at least 20 years in advance of us. I want you to take your scientists and your engineers, go into Europe, find out what exists, the best of the technology, the best of the documentation, the scientists, the engineers, put together a program that will put our Air Force 20, 30, 40, 50 years ahead. That's how far-reaching and how far-thinking General Arnold was. So the phenomenon itself was being reported at these levels. And General Eisenhower's office, again, the reports that I uncovered called them night phenomenon as the subject heading. And that was lumped in there, of course, the Foo Fighters sightings is what instigated it. I'd like to point out also that we probably would not have heard of the Foo Fighters during the war. It would have been after the war, of course, where we first heard about it. But in January of 1945, the phenomenon itself broke in the major press, Associated Press, New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, all picked up on this story, only because an AP reporter, Bob Wilson, had gone to the 415th Night Fighter Squadron on New Year's Eve. It was his, what he was trying to do was to have a story to be the first reporter over Germany when the New Year came in on January 1st. He wanted to be over Germany reporting a combat mission and be the first. He thought that'd be very unique. Unfortunately, the weather grounded the whole unit. So they invited him to stay on and said, look, you know, if you want a story, we can give you one. And that's where he learned about the Foo Fighters. So it was because of that particular report is why we started to hear about it in January. And other than that, it's we would never have known about the phenomenon until probably years later, and probably who knows what would have come out of it. We have a December article of the American Legion magazine by Joe Chamberlain who talked about the mystery. But there was not much coming out. But the high-level command, we know, were involved, and there is documentation. And through my book, you can see it now, where the Air Ministry and General Eisenhower's office were discussing it.
We have another question here from Eternal Being, and he asks, are there any indications that some Japanese had prior warning by ET to get out of Hiroshima or Nagasaki before the bomb dropped?
I'm sorry, but that's unknown to me. I'm not aware of that. I know that Mr. Stringfield was the first person who I ever talked with who brought to my attention his feelings of the bombs themselves. The dropping of the bombs brought the attention of what he considered to be extraterrestrial nature, and he felt that's what started the heavy inundation of observations. That he's the first one I spoke with personally about that.
Was there any other individuals that were involved in the official Foo Fighter investigations during World War II that later went on and became either well-known or partially known to do some investigation into UFOs after the war? Any other involvement?
No, the only thing we know for sure through that the Robertson panel report is that three scientists were involved. We know Robertson investigated them. We know Dr. Luis Alvarez investigated them. We know Griggs. But we don't know what happened to them post-war until 1953 when Dr. Robertson chaired the panel. And that particular meeting, they were just trying to find out if UFOs were a national security threat. We don't know what happened after that in terms of World War II figures. But I can tell you something intriguing is Colonel Howard McCoy, who was in charge of air technical intelligence, in 1944, if you look at it this way, here's a man who's coordinating the efforts by Air Technical Intelligence out of Wright Field to go in and find out what exactly the Germans had aeronautically. That's everything across the board. So you can bet that at some point, Dr. Griggs, Dr. Robertson, somebody in the investigation had contacted these air technical intelligence teams who were being directed by Colonel McCoy. We jump to 1947, and of course the Roswell incident took place. And we know for a fact that a lot of officers involved were World War II veterans. And then by 1948, Project Sign has now started. And what's significant about that is the intelligence director at Wright Field, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base now, was General Howard McCoy, who had been, I think he's a brigadier general by then. So this man was involved with all the intelligence gathering from 1944 throughout the end of the war, all the way into the investigations of UFOs with the United States Air Force's Project Sign. So that tells me there's good indication that there was high-level communication, and some of the scientists and some of the people were involved. But that's the closest thing I can tell you in terms of somebody who I'm aware of. And again, he has never stated that. That would be, of course, Brigadier General McCoy.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Luis Alvarez investigate the green fireball sightings in New Mexico?
Yes, but again, that was meteoric. It was Lincoln LaPaz. Dr. Lincoln LaPaz was the one, I believe, who was actually directing that investigation with the Fourth Army.
You're right. I stand corrected.
It's okay. I get them confused, too. And again, the investigation is so full of holes in terms of lack of information, I wouldn't be surprised if Alvarez was not at least approached, because it had to do with radar. A lot of radar, you know, sightings were being recorded, and of course radar was a big deal in terms of national defense. So things coming in to our airspace, of course, was on radar. And Dr. Alvarez was a leading expert on radar during the war, as was Dr. Griggs. And so it stands to reason that these men were involved, and that's where we need to find more documentation, at least to determine their involvement.
Okay, yeah. There's so many names sometimes it's hard to remember and keep them all straight who did what. We have about 5 minutes left. If you'd like to let everybody know where they can find your book.
Okay, you can find my book, I guess, at your local bookstore. You can go in there and order it, your Barnes & Nobles, your Borders. They won't have it on the bookshelf. Just order it. Of course, it won't cost you shipping and handling. Or you can go to Amazon.com and Anomalous Books is responsible for putting my book out. And I think you won't have any trouble in any of these areas. And I really appreciate being on the show tonight.
Oh, I appreciate it, too. I think we got enough time to sneak in one more quick question here. Gossamer777 asks, I've heard UFO stories from personnel supposedly attached to SHAPE later on, but is there any indication that a special group was set up within SHAPE during World War II for UFO reports?
I would say yes. Of course, the term didn't exist, but again, that would be Dr. Robertson. The documentation shows that Dr. Robertson was asked to investigate it, and we know for a fact it was put into place. So for him to do an investigation, he was pulling his sources from many, many intelligence apparatus that had been involved in World War II. I'm sure Navy was involved. I'm sure the British Air Ministry. All this was being collected, and this was at the SHAPE level. And he, of course, his information would have been given to General Eisenhower in one form or another. And so, yes, that's the high-level investigation, and it was definitely in place. And, of course, we know for a fact now that Dr. Robertson was involved with that.
Well, cool. By chance, have you gone on any speaking engagements about your research?
I've I recently spoke at a local community college, and I to one of the local MUFON groups. But no, I have not. I'd like to. I would certainly enjoy going out and speaking at some of the, like the MUFON conference or some of the conferences around the country. I would really enjoy that. And I'm still investigating. I'm still researching. I never stop. I still go to the National Archives, and it's just a long haul. I'm trying to uncover further information that will help put the story, fill it out some. There's a lot of questions, more questions now than I had going in.
Have you considered doing any research on, like, say, the Japanese side of the story or the German side of the story?
Well, yes, but then again, it would require that I go to Japan or Germany to really get into their archives. And the problem is, of course, it's a language barrier because I can't speak Japanese or German or read it. And I'm able to go to the National Archives so often because I'm in close proximity. So I've used that as my home base, and I'm analyzing interrogation reports and things like that. So I am limited. Being one man and unable to speak the languages, it will limit my ability. That's why I'm hoping researchers around the world will jump on this and start to put together a bigger picture.
Oh, that would be an interesting collaborative effort if you could get people from all over the planet getting in on this.
Because there was
conflict in Africa, Europe, Asia, all during that era.
Absolutely. And we're missing documents. We're missing reports. We don't know how many reports there were. So it's like, you know, everything I'm talking about is geared towards the European theater, the Mediterranean theater, and the Japanese theater of operations. But what I gather through the literature, through the decades, this was a worldwide phenomenon that took place over many decades, many years, centuries possibly, as we discussed about the artwork. So, of course, my work sorely needs help in terms of more people jumping on and around the world who can add to this body of work. And then, of course, it'll give a whole new perspective, and who knows what we'll uncover.
Mm. Very true. And unfortunately, that's it. We're all out of time. I could go on for longer on this subject. This was fascinating.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Dee.
Well, I thank you very much for coming on tonight and sharing just a small amount of what you've learned and put together. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and also to thank all those who joined us in the Palfoc Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Tonight, her guest is Dr. Melvin C. Redfern. And please join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, where my guest will be researcher David Rudiak. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone. And we're clear.
Thank you
so
much.
That was awesome.